kissed. Finally, we sat on the edge of the bed, and he flopped backward, his hands over his head. I never expected to feel this way. You are someone I know, have known all my life. I've never known anyone as easily. Are you sure we didn't meet in another life? I am both thrown by and drawn to his eyes, one tawny like a tiger's eye bead, the other the faded blue of an old chambray shirt. I know, I know. I laid my head on his chest, listening to the solid thud of his heart. We talked about the vintners, the evening, the shock of Roebuck on our tongues, about whether Kit is pregnant. He loves Susan and Camille. He says with all of us he feels released. I know that feeling as well. My friends multiply my life. After those umpteen tastings of wine, I simply drifted, fell asleep. I said, "We're all right." Silence. I remember saying, "Your eyes excite me," then hearing a low, honking snore. Later, I woke up and found that we'd stretched out side by side on the bed, Chris curled around me, holding my hand, his even breath behind my ear. I disentangled and crept out to my room. Kit was turned away, though I suspected that she'd awakened. I crawled under the blanket, still in my clothes. My composing methods may sometimes be suspect. How do I know about this scene? Her pages were folded into our guidebook. Susan went to the room to call her daughters in California. Morning there. Evening already falling here by 5 in the afternoon. We're swinging toward the darkest day of the year. Does my little sugar spoon of protoplasm feel the earth moving on its axis? I walk back by the baby shop and examine the onesies, the minute yellow sweater, fragile embroidered dresses only grandmothers would buy. My mother will miss everything. Lace-trimmed socks, impossibly tiny lambskin shoes. This is Italy, after all. The other window displays folding strollers, room monitors, bouncy chairs, and high and mighty navy blue and white carriages that look constructed for royal bairns. I'm stunned, not having thought until now of all the paraphernalia in my, our, future. I share the Italians' fearful superstitions. I wouldn't think of buying anything until I'm practically on the way to the hospital. But I snap a photo of the shoes and send it to Colin. It seems like longer than yesterday that we were in Aquileia. That's travel. Time expands and compresses in unexpected ways. Just to take in one of the most pleasing piazzas I've ever seen, I order a hazelnut gelato at a cafe on Piazza della Libertà and spend half an hour looking at passers-by and patterns of shifting shadows. The great poet Czesław Miłosz was right. The tragedy of living is to have only one life when there are many possibilities laid before us. Shouldn't one spend a life, or at least part of it, in Udine? Camille has covered a lot of ground during her afternoon in Venice. She's sent home vials and packets of pigments from a miracle of an art supply store. Her project is coming clear to her now, and she hasn't even picked up a brush. She stocked up on handmade paper and will work with Mathilde and Serena as she needs more. Browsing in venerable bookstores, she spent almost €1,000 on decaying leather books with pages of drawings and etchings of Venetian buildings and country villas, a few tomes of Renaissance poetry, and in a regular bookstore she splurged on art books. Giorgione, Palladio, Veronese. How she feels, she only can liken to falling in love, when every sense is heightened and intensified, when extraneous emotions fall away. She feels like a lens in the sun. After two trains, a vaporetto, and miles of walking, her new knee throbs. Her calf muscle wants to cramp with every step back to the hotel. Even so, you just should not have room service in Venice. After a rest, she hauls herself up and slowly walks back to a six-table trattoria she passed earlier. Without the others to hear, her Italian improves. She orders with no hitch. Over a bowl of mussels and a grilled fish, she meets Americans at the next table, a young couple from Baltimore traveling to Europe for the first time. After the usual "where are you from?" conversation and observations about Venice, the woman asks Camille, "Are you retired or do you work?" Camille answers, "I used to teach. Now I'm a full-time artist." She has the whole next day to play. The buoyant excitement gives her bolts of energy, slightly tamped by her irritated knee. She frequently stops for coffee or water. They didn't get to see the Carpaccios when they were here before. She adores the painting of Saint Ursula sleeping in her bedroom while the angel pauses at the door bringing her palm frond of martyrdom. Why is she martyred? She fled her father's marriage plan for her, taking along with her on several ships 11,000 other virgins. He'd betrothed her to the barbarian Conan. She's about to suffer her fate. She's peaceful now in her lovely room with the little dog by her bed. By chance, Camille discovers the hidden in plain sight Carlo Scarpa Museum, actually his office design for Olivetti typewriters, right on Piazza Grande, but inconspicuous. A place to fall deeper into whatever she's falling into. She lingers on the details, the brass cylinders supporting the marble stairs, adamantly modern lines so quietly executed that they seem timeless, the sculpture on a square of water, always water, reminding you that you're in Venice. "Here I am," she thinks, "with Scarpa, the amazing architect. I'm beginning a long romance with him." She returns to the bookstore and buys a detailed and illustrated Scarpa book, then rushes to the Querini Stampaglia Palace and Garden for a quick look at the Scarpa revisions. Susan should be here for the garden. Camille raises her arms over her head and shakes back her hair. "Now I'm on fire," she thinks. Timorous to tinsel. She limps a little on the way back to the hotel, but hums as she goes, "I set fire to the rain." We must have a dinner with Colin and talk Venetian architecture. Scarpa loved Roman lettering. I'll tell Rowan all about that. After dinner, she falls asleep with Scarpa, savoring what he loved: Japanese design, polished stucco, base materials used with precious ones, water. Always for this son of Venice, water. Water lapping doors, seeping under doors, doors opening to water, back doors opening to narrow streets. Damp, water, the mind soaked, the body soaked, and drifting. 7 hours later, she wakes up with Charles in her vision, from a dream of walking along Spit Creek in their backyard. No narrative. There he is. Saturday clothes, tennis shoes, just walking as he did a million times along the path to the bridge he built himself, over to a short woodland walk. He's going to see if the white cyclamen are blooming, Camille thinks, as she hauls out of sleep. Then she is awake. She parts the drapery just as the prow of a gondola passes her window. From the canals of Venice to Spit Creek. Charles, good for you. I'm glad you're checking on the garden. We spent our last day wrapping up their research. From Udine, we chased a lead up to Manyago, a town famous for the production of knives. Chris wanted to find one place his clients could find unique items to buy or import for their retail stores. The artisan knives could inspire elegant murders. Slim and sculptural, the stiletto points make you want to pick up one and perhaps pierce someone's heart. They look way too refined to gut or skin something. I bought a jade green one for Colin. The handles are horn, antler, or the pretty colors of perlex, whatever that is. Maybe he will cut the string on packages. Oh, cut the umbilical cord. After a brief visit to the Cutlery Museum, we knew all we wanted to know about knife making and drove back to Cormon's for our last dinner. Up early and on the road, Chris ramps up the sound of K.D. Lang, all of us belting out Hallelujah, and then her incomparable hookup with Roy Orbison, crying. Bare poplars on the roadside whizzing by, everyone happy with having seen new sights. Chris weaving around tractors, beating out time with the heel of his hand on the steering wheel, until we hit traffic and the van subdues everyone in a travel trance. I fall asleep. Camille made her train easily, arriving in Padova station in time to wait and wait for the others. Their trusted navigating systems neglected to know about road construction. She'd been standing in front of the station for an hour before she sees the van swing into the taxi stand lane, Susan leaning out the window, waving. There's Camille. Look at her. She looks sort of disheveled, but vibrant. Susan threw jackets into the back so she could get in. Do you suppose she met that Rowan in Venice? Camille piles in. She's picked up a sack of panini in the station. We fall upon them, and Chris turns up the music again, Sam Cooke. All of them know the words to You Send Me and Change Is Gonna Come. Invasion. Outside San Rocco, the gang needs to organize. Chris stops at a supermarket and they gather supplies for the evening. He is coming to dinner, and Camille has invited Rowan. Kit demurs, wanting an evening alone with Colin. They pick up Archie, who seems reluctant to rejoin his family after the tasty lamb bones, after being allowed to sleep on the foot of the bed and to run wild chasing dumb guinea hens around the farm. They drop off Chris at his hotel, and then Kit, who leaps out as Colin jogs down the driveway to meet her, his arms flung open and a big smile lighting his face. Susan turns into their drive and the three of them breathe a collective sigh. Great trip, but great to be home. As they slow to descend the driveway, Julia leans forward. Oh no, we left the front door open. Wait, we wouldn't leave the door open. A packing crate stands off to the right. A panel of light falls from the doorway into the garden. The lights are on. Susan stops in front rather than driving around back as they usually do. The door is open, Camille repeats. Damn, someone has broken in. Maybe Grazia is here, but her car isn't. Julia slides open the van door. Archie leaps out and runs inside. Archie! Susan shouts. Come here! She's afraid that someone, possibly, is still inside. Archie! She irrationally leans on the horn. Silence. Julia and Camille get out cautiously and walk to the side of the house, to the kitchen door they always use, since they have only the big iron key to the front. Silence. Susan keeps leaning on the horn. If thieves remain inside, she wants their attention. The entrance looks normal, but Julia and Camille find the window by the kitchen shattered. A garden table pulled up underneath allowed someone to climb in. Julia points to two clear footprints. They walk back to the front, and the three decide to enter together. Suddenly, they hear someone from behind the house shouting their names. Here comes Leo, asking what's wrong, uttering Madonna curses with every breath. What's the matter? Oh, Dio! And Aneta running up behind him, almost squawking. Together, they cautiously enter the house. The hallway looks normal. The first thing they see in the kitchen is Archie, transfixed and rigid in his best pointer mode, glaring at the kitchen fireplace. Three white kittens curl in a bread basket lined with a towel. Ample food and water surround them, and their donor has taken the time to spread newspapers for their convenience. In the sink, plates and forks, two wine glasses. Julia recognizes the leftover pasta with ragu she'd left in the freezer. Christ on a cracker. They had dinner. Can you believe the wine glasses? What wine did they open? Oh, where's my cherry still life? Susan notices. Where's our new food processor? Julia surveys the kitchen but finds nothing else missing. What the hell? Camille asks. We've been robbed, but they've left cats. This is insane. Dinner? They had dinner? They knew without doubt that we were gone. Then Julia finds the drawers in the dining room dumped out, napkins and placemats scattered, silverware everywhere on the floor, the thieves apparently not interested. The sofa and chair cushions lie scattered in the middle of the floor. As Leo points out, as all is swimming into focus for the women, every mirror, print, and painting has been taken down. All are lined up along the walls rather carefully.
They were looking for a safe, Leo says. They were interested in money.
He called his friend Eugenio, the head of the police, whose six-month-old daughter at the dinner had munched olives. Camille crosses the room and turns down the hall to her bedroom. She spots a bracelet on the floor at the threshold and, inside, mounds of upturned clothes, the mattress skewed on the bed. This can't be. She closes her eyes. They took my jewelry. Because the police have not arrived, she doesn't want to touch anything. The white gold links on the brick give her hope that she has not lost all the touching mementos Charles had given her throughout their marriage. The gold rope necklace with a sapphire clasp, bought in Charleston when he turned 50 and he'd said, because of our happiness, all the years we've shared. The pearls with a strand of amethyst woven in, and the romantic cascade of four diamond earrings. 25th anniversary. She never owned a lot of jewelry, but what she has is good, really good. She wore one piece every day and thought of the occasion that brought it to her, a moment of meditation on the good luck of her love. Her wedding present, a teardrop emerald with tiny diamonds along the chain. Please don't let that be gone, she whispers out loud. Before her, the emerald had been Charles's darling mother's gift from his father when they married. No other objects she owns have half the emotional meaning. Aneta sets to work putting the dining room in order until Susan stops her. Fingerprints, she says. Tampering with a crime scene, she says, forgetting that Aneta speaks no English. She gestures to her fingertips, and Aneta shouts, Certo, cara. Certainly, my dear. Camille loops her hand through Susan's arm. I'm afraid all my jewelry is gone. I'm an idiot. I left my drawstring pouches in my bottom drawer. Oh, my friend, I'm afraid. She and Julia have already looked upstairs, where, mysteriously, nothing seems disturbed except the upended mattresses.
At home, I'm always hiding my stash of jewelry, in plastic bags under the sugar, in the toy chest under Charlie's drums, in a tampon box. I never slid them between sheets in the linen closet, under my lingerie, the obvious places, nowhere near the mattress, or pillows, or bookcases, or handbags, or fake shaving cream, or tomato soup cans. Certainly not hollowed out books. And now, my God, stupid. I could have left them in the dryer under a pile of t-shirts. I've had many ingenious places before. So good that I often forget where I stashed them. Charlie always teases me about my places to hide my treasures. Once, one pouch was lost for 6 months, then found in Charles's toolbox in the garage. Susan had much experience with clients' houses robbed while listed for sale. She'd heard of every hiding place imaginable, but before this trip to Venice, she'd found the ultimate one for her own jewelry. I just looked. My stuff is still in its hiding place. I wish I'd mentioned it. You know the brush by the toilet, standing in that stainless steel container? I've noticed that every Italian bathroom has one. It's because of poor toilet design. I put the things I wasn't traveling with in a plastic bag and stored it under the brush in the container. Camille manages a laugh. The carabinieri arrive. Eugenio, the maresciallo, the marshal, sweeps Camille into a huge hug. The three men in their spiffy uniforms look as if they could handle major crime. One speaks excellent English, having lived in New Jersey for several years. They comb the house. One takes photos. No use to look for fingerprints, they assert. The thieves are not dumb. They wear gloves. They ascertain, as we already had from the way the glass scattered, that they entered by the back hall window and exited through the front door. Susan thinks, Sherlock Holmes. When Julia triumphantly points out the footprints, they collectively shrug. Everyone wears athletic shoes like that. We enter the bedroom. Gone. Everything. The ladri took the time to untie the jewelry roll, open the blue satin pouch, remove the contents, and leave the holders on the pile of underwear and turned over drawers. The red pouch holding the emerald, gone. The one piece of costume jewelry, a string of glass beads, was rejected and remains on the floor, but one of the guys accidentally grinds it under his boot. Camille picks up the white gold bracelet in the doorway. They probably thought it was junk. More hugs all around from the police, who are especially moved, and keep repeating to each other that the pearls came from Camille's mother, a mother's jewelry being most resonant to them. Then there erupts a discussion of hiding places. A safe? Absolutely not. They maintain again that thieves are not stupid. They have tools to rip that wall safe right out and buzz into it. Should we have video surveillance? No. You think they don't wear masks? Julia doubts that they ate her ragu and drank the Chianti Reserva in masks and gloves. The handsome chief advises, choose a flower pot in the garden and dig a hole under it. Or there, the tall, muscular one demonstrates, wedged on top of a beam in the kitchen. They can't look on top of all the beams in the house, he reasons, just as they can't dig under all the flower pots. This is getting surreal, Susan mutters. Camille didn't say that every time she wants her earrings, she does not want to unearth them from the garden. Besides, scorpions love living under pots. It's getting late. Anyway, she now has nothing to hide from any jewel thief. Susan questions the carabinieri about searching at gold dealers for the jewelry. Useless. They put on their coats. The gold will be melted down by morning.
Gypsies, they conclude.
They're camped outside Florence and are raiding the country towns. It's mostly women for these small jobs. If they're noticed, they claim to be house cleaners. The kittens, though, that's a new touch.
They depart. Nothing to offer. No lead to follow.
Aneta and Leo make the rounds of hugs, too, and go home. We stare at the three frisky kittens Archie is circling, obviously enamored. Julia starts the washer. No one wants to touch the garments handled by the smart women thieves, who somehow had known their schedule. Too bad they had not ransacked Julia's room instead of Camille's.
That's Susan. Smart.
When Julia left Wade, she'd stored every piece of jewelry she owned, except for one gold necklace from her father, good to wear with anything, in a safe deposit box in Savannah. Of course, Lizzie had long ago sold Julia's mother's treasures. Leo stops by and tells Colin and me. We rush right over, just as Chris arrives by taxi, totally unaware of what happened. Rowan drives up too, alighting with an armful of lilies.
"You all were great to help us clean up this chaos," Susan said. She opens a bottle of cold Prosecco and raises a toast. "It could have been worse."
A man sent by the police arrives to board up the window, and Susan hands him a glass, too.
"Unfortunately not," Camille has answered multiple times. No, she never had gotten around to insuring her jewelry beyond the household policy. Beat on head again.
"We've been told a million times how safe it is here," Camille said.
Everyone laments with her, but Susan remarks, "Everyone keeps saying how sad the loss of such sentimental gifts. And yes, that's true. But I'm also thinking, yeah, and how sad the loss of all that gold at $2,000 an ounce."
"What was that about not looking for the jewelry because it would be melted down by morning? Emeralds don't melt. Sapphires don't melt."
Susan stands behind Camille's chair, her hands protectively on Camille's shoulders.
"I'm going to cook," Julia says. "Let's move into the kitchen and I'll give everyone a job. Chris, if you'll put on the pasta water. Susan, salad. Rowan, please set the table. Kit, you and Colin must stay. We need moral support. Would you two open the wine and find the big glasses? Several bottles, I'd say. I make a killer carbonara. Camille, you just stay where you are."
"I know it's shallow," Camille continues, "to be so upset over material things. I know it's a first world problem."
"Don't be silly," Julia answers. "You'll never get over this."
"I'll buy you a diamond as big as the Ritz," Rowan jokes. "By the way, what's that big crate outside? Did the robbers leave you a gift?"
Susan laughs.
"That's the start of my new business. More on that later. We've had quite a day."
Not the festive evening they'd planned, but not the worst.
Everyone told their stories of losses. A truck backed up to a house in Napa while the owners were away and took everything, even the refrigerator. A stolen car, a bicycle, a friend who had her bag snatched.
Camille is not consoled. Julia serves a mound of spaghetti alla carbonara to each, and they eat every morsel. Colin keeps his arm around me.
Chris and Rowan insist on sleeping over. They help make up beds in two upstairs bedrooms. The carabinieri guaranteed that the gypsies would not be back, and also pledged to patrol the road every hour. But everyone feels safer with a full house, and they're able to say buonanotte with more calm than they anticipated.
Archie falls asleep beside the fireplace with three kittens curled against him, as though he were the mother.
Oh, Madonna Serpente, Susan says,
her first Tuscan curse, overheard in the olive grove, and it's a big one.
Snake Madonna.
In the night, Rowan worries. He stealthily pads barefoot down the stairs and slowly opens Camille's door. She is still awake, drowsing over a book.
Just checking on you.
He sits down on the side of the bed.
What a blow. I am so sorry. What can I do? Can I just hold you until you fall asleep?
Camille slides down under the covers. Yes, please. After all the words, plain human warmth comforts her. Upstairs, Susan sleeps. She was up late, too wired to relax, firing off emails. Julia crosses the hall to Chris's room. He is out for the count, but sits up immediately, thinking the robbers are back.
Julia, shit! What a nightmare for you. But, whoa, you are a vision.
She peels off her nightgown over her head and tosses back the covers. You're leaving tomorrow. When will we have a chance to be together again? Clasps and Chains. I knew the story of the robbery at Villa Assunta would be all over town by the time Colin and I walked in for coffee. We're settled at Bar Beato Angelico, with cappuccinos and pastries, but we hardly can take a bite or sip for people coming over to our table to discuss the terrible event. We are taking a train late this morning to Florence. Colin has made an appointment for us with an obstetrician, someone recommended by one of the architects on his project. I'm nervous, always nervous at the prospect of feet in stirrups and someone saying, "Just relax." I have been avoiding the ordeal. In San Rocco, when something bad happens, people take it personally. Everyone here is sorry and embarrassed that the nice American women were robbed, and everyone has a theory. A certain disreputable guy who does odd jobs comes in for a lot of blame. Gypsies, yes. Anytime something happens, the gypsies are blamed. Not that much happens. A tourist got all upset because her wallet was lifted, and then it was spotted in the chair next to where she had coffee earlier. Drunk teenagers vandalized a house under construction. A dog ate poisoned meat, but many thought he had it coming after a solid month of all-night moon barking. Of course, an older woman has a lot of jewelry. She should have known better than to leave it under clothing. Her hiding place was bad. Because of wide distrust of banks and a tendency to avoid revealing income that will be taxed, many Italians keep cash at home. Just look under the flower pots. Most have a foolproof place to conceal valuables, and it's not behind books or in the toe of a shoe. A pity, the consensus goes, some of the jewelry came from her mother. I speculate to Colin, what comes after all this? The thief's wife may at this moment have hidden inside a sock the handful of pearl earrings, the emerald, and the pearl necklace that couldn't be melted. Maybe her ugly husband yanked off the gold parts, but maybe he left them intact for her, love of his life, and in a few months she may lift out the creamy pearls and fasten the gold clasp around her neck. She may look in the mirror and try to imagine where they came from. Maybe she will dare to wear the dangling, lustrous pearls. On that same day, Camille may be at the market and see a woman lean over to buy apples, her pearls swinging out. Not one of the great losses of the world. Not important in the face of the poor struggling to survive, dead-end wars and terrorists, or people not respecting the earth enough to take care of it. On and on, Colin says. But yes, the world is private, too, And when your home is invaded and a lifetime's collection of intensely personal belongings is ripped away, a lingering sadness starts up. Camille felt stripped, mentally assaulted, really angry. Thing is, losing jewelry isn't at all like losing money. It's romance, heritage, an inner concept of beauty. That's why those fragile earrings found in Etruscan tombs move us with their sense of the ancient wearer. She's touching her earlobes 2,600 years ago, and you feel it. I love my mother's ring, her bluest of eyes, her generosity. And my mean aunt's ring, did she love, ever, sparkles on my little finger. I'd much rather lose the money they're worth.
Right. You're always right. If you compare importance to world events, your own life always will seem frivolous. You start where I leave off, my love.
Don't be ridiculous. By the way, I rolled up a lot of cash and shoved it into an empty wine bottle. It's corked and standing with my vinegars.
The bills unfurl.
How will we get it out of a bottle?
Easy. Break the bottle.
Now, off to the game-changing appointment. By my calculations, I am 10 weeks along and overdue for this exam. I did start prenatal vitamins as soon as I knew for sure. The embryo soon turns into a fetus. Etymology, offspring. The creature right now weighs only 1/4 ounce. But has lungs, heart, all the vital organs already working. This makes my knees want to buckle. Something 3 centimeters long already has a stomach and fingernails. As Sylvia Plath put it, I've boarded the train, there's no getting off. As you already know, I am perpetually surprised at life's basic functions. How a spider knows how to construct an intricate web. How stars wheel across the sky. How the heart keeps on thudding. I'm naturally going to be struck with wonder over the creation of another human for the planet. Part 4. What's more precious? As the story circulated around town, everyone told the 3 women a story of their own losses or the losses of friends and family. Like labor sagas for the pregnant woman, these stories don't help. They inspire further fear. But cumulatively, Camille had to see that she was not unique, at least. And for those who had lost life savings they'd jammed in a milk carton in the fridge, she was among the lucky who'd lost only jewelry. She rejected that. Over lunch at Stefano's, she confessed to Rowan that some primordial part of her, deep in the medulla, wondered if making love with him incited the gods to take away Charles's gifts to her. He laughed her out of that one. But something primitive in her feared retribution. Rowan countered, "This is a different take. You just came home from Venice, fired up over your own life, this project you haven't told me much about. You've come home with supplies and art books, pigments and poetry and architecture, laden with riches. Odd that the mementos, all clasps and chains, when you think about it, of your former life, disappear at the same moment these new stimuli appear. Do you possibly agree?" Stefano sets down a platter of crostini.
"What is so serious?" he asked. "Everything's better with these and a glass of vino."
Camille is silent. Rowan's is a mysterious interpretation, something to contemplate. But then she says, "No, I can't leap to that mystical level. I don't like the eye for an eye idea. So mean. Look at all the people who are horrendously rich and nothing is taken away from them in order for them to move forward with purchasing a helicopter for their yacht. Why should I, part-time art teacher with a frugal husband, have to lose to gain?
Rowan laughs.
Touché. But I'm still struck with this timing. If you take it as a symbol, it might help.
After lunch, they go to his place for the afternoon. She wakes late in the day, languorous and sated, but with a twinge of sadness. She thinks of how many times in her life she's turned to sex instead of what she might have otherwise pursued. Why hasn't she begun the work she now knows she wants to do? The gifts begin to arrive. Leo brings over wooden salt and pepper grinders he made out of fruit woods. He even leaves packets of coarse salt and whole peppercorns to grind. The owner of the linen shop, where they've bought tablecloths, invites Susan in and gives her 3 hand-woven cotton dish towels, almost too nice to use. Stefano discounts their lunch by half. In the wine store, Giampaolo gives them a bottle of grappa. 4 lovely notes are left stuck in the gate. Patrizia, the woman gathering greens whom Julia met on the road, appears at the door with a pan of lasagna. All these spontaneous gifts leave the women with nights to ponder their meaning, the loving spirit of what is given, the grand subtraction of what is taken away. Camille hopes for a silver lining. The jewelry will be returned in a paper sack by the front door. The police will turn into the driveway, siren jubilantly blaring. They've recovered everything. The thieves are in jail. Every time she gets dressed, she wishes for the necklace with the crystal box of happy diamonds that Charles gave her for a big birthday. Or the dangly amethyst earrings, the color of Tuscan grapes. She thinks of when her old mother, Pearls, once broke in a restaurant, sending waiters and Charles to scurry under tables. I won't replace the jewelry, she thinks, not even if I could. I'm sorry I won't be passing it on to my granddaughter, but so be it. Now that I know what it's like to lose it, I won't experience that again. Charles, lost. All his gifts, lost. This loss attaching to the loss of him, loss on loss falling through me, a cement-filled box thrown into the ocean. She remembers something from the dream of him on the woodland walk. Cyclamen. He'd turned and, smiling, said, "More precious than jewels." At first, he did not come to Italy. Now he again can walk around in her mind. She had not expected this roaming ghost. When her parents, her older sister, cousins, friends died, and there have been many by now, they all retreated after the period of fresh grief, surfacing when she was reminded that Sophie adored anemones, or Mother's house smelled like this pine oil and brownies. Or Billie Holiday was singing that night when Ralph... Her parents, much loved, never visited her dreams. Her mother comes closest to her when Camille searches her yellowed and brittle recipes for cornmeal fried okra and caramel cake, or brown sugar muffins and grits souffle. Her father comes back when she hears someone whistle as clear as a bird, or she passes a golf course, or sees someone nip back a bourbon in one gulp. Her sister, Sophie, whose breast cancer metastasized radically, appears only in quick images, skipping rope, falling off her horse, fainting in a soft heap at her wedding. Immortality, she'd always thought, is how you live on in the memories of those left. She's saddened to find that so little remains on a day-to-day basis. but she's beginning to feel heartened that the force to move it pushes strongly through her. If she'd stayed home, she muses, she would have revived her book club, picked up Ingrid at school, kept up with colleagues, attended art department lectures, maybe opted for Cornwallis Meadows, a lucky end unit with hummingbird feeder and swing on the porch. That nice Catherine at the orientation, moving down from the north, would come over for tea in the afternoons. Nothing wrong with that. But what if I'd missed Villa Assunta? 1,000 images rush in. Venice, her studio, the paper workshop, Rowan's beard rough on her breasts, Julia laughing in the kitchen, everyone toasting and sharing all the new experiences at dinner, Susan's joyous and maniacal maneuvering in their blue Fiat, countless explosions of taste, amazement at markets, sweet San Rocco, and the light crossing the piazza like a sundial at all times of day. The three damn thieves' cats cavorting about the house and weaseling into their hearts. Oh, yes, they have names. Bimba, Ragazzo, and Vino. The latter bestowed after dinner, when the minx jumped on the table from Susan's lap and licked her glass. Susan's sphere. To unpack the crate that might have arrived during the robbers' dinner and ransacking, Susan asks Leo for help. Maybe one of the thieves ambled to the door, wine glass in hand, and signed for it. Cheeky bitches. Nailed and constructed as though it contains the Mona Lisa, the crate holds instead an astrolabe and a stone statue heavy as the Rock of Gibraltar. As Susan was leaving the Peggy Guggenheim Sculpture Garden in Venice, she passed an antique shop filled with things you wouldn't think mortals could own for mere money. Amid immense Baroque paintings, complicated reliquaries with marble angels, and ornately gilded, carved, and brocaded furniture, she spotted a rusty astrolabe. She wasn't then sure of the name, but knew it was some sky-charting instrument, mounted on a curlicued iron base. Beside it, a stone garden statue, a pedestal surmounted by the slim figure of Mercury with a tight smile, almost a smirk. Small, maybe in total 4 feet tall. She thought, that's the size God should be. Quick and nimble, moving among the clouds, earth, and the underworld. Didn't Mercury go to the underworld? Seduce someone on the way down? She loved his pointed helmet with wings that looked blown back, and the winged heels of his sandals. It would be marvelous to have such clip-on wings. Just lift off and cross the Grand Canal. The shop owner opened the door.
May I be of assistance, signora? You are admiring my Mercury? He is the god of travelers like you, you must know.
I did not, Susan answered, but he could be the god of a beautiful garden. She shook his hand and stepped inside.
Sono Renzo Schiavoni, he said, introducing himself.
His tight suit shone like sterling silver, and his waxy, slicked-back hair required such ample products that Susan found herself trying to imagine peering into his bathroom cabinet. She told him her name, and that she has a garden in Tuscany that needs a god.
Obviously, your garden already has its goddess.
He smiled. Always the polite flirtation in Italy, even in overrun Venice.
Grazie, signore.
Susan laughed very loudly. The globular bronze instrument intrigued her. Tell me about this. I know it's not a sundial. I know it somehow plots the heavens. She leaned to examine the intersecting spheres pierced through by a long arrow, the angle of the Earth's inclination, she assumes.
Brava! You're admiring a spherical astrolabe, also called an armillary sphere. See how good my English is? The ancients were smart. This device gave them the ability to calculate altitudes of stars, positions of the moon and earth, positions of themselves. They were hers. Susan mentally placed them in the garden at Villa Assunta. A garden thrives on punctuation marks and a place to be drawn to. She imagined Mercury greeting her and her friends as they alight from the car. How mysterious the astrolabe would look in a bed of Artemisia and Yarrow. Are those two plants as ancient as the Roman gods? Did the astronomers calculate and cavort amid patches of lamb's ear and dianthus? The prices were astronomical, too. Renzo was ready to negotiate politely up to 10% off, but he had not reckoned on dealing with the top-selling real estate agent from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who combined inquisitiveness, charm, and plain savvy to bring him down 30%, including shipping. He couldn't help but admire her. Leo pries open the boards but calls for Colin and a dolly to haul Mercury out of the box. There he stands, sentinel of the front garden. The astrolabe Susan places in front of a stone terrace wall near the iron benches she'd dragged out of the Limonaya when they first arrived. What a perfect place to sit and contemplate those brilliant ancients who invented such an instrument. Nerds, they must have been, like her daughters and their associates in Silicon Valley. Susan is thinking of the garden in spring and summer, but her thinking is like this astrolabe in intersecting rings. She's projecting, that moment when a single thought stretches out into an arc that lands in the future. "Ah, you're spinning out. How marvelous," Aaron used to say. On impulse, she'd given Signor Schiavoni her card. "Please email me when you acquire other garden antiques," she said. "I love sundials and iron trellises and stone lions raised up on their haunches. Even those, I know they're common, four-season statues." She left the shop with lights strobing in her head. She'd seen iron fan lights, lion face fountains, and fanciful gates at the Arezzo Antique Market and had paused to look without seeing beyond each. Now she connects the dots. Walking back to the hotel, avoiding tourists' elbows and shopping bags, she dialed Molly Dodge in Chapel Hill. On houses that Susan had listed for sale, they'd worked together many times staging the properties by taking portraits, sideboards, and lamps from Molly's Barney Antique Store and giving character to lackluster interiors, or even completely furnishing a house whose owners had moved out. She'd especially loved setting tables for imagined guests and creating serene bedrooms in pale teal toiles.
"Ciao, Bella!"
Susan almost shouted over the din of tourists.
"I'm calling you from Venice." "You are kidding," Molly shouted back. "I am so envious I can't even speak."
They talked about home news, with Susan's eyes welling up, a fierce attack of homesickness right in the middle of Campo Santo Stefano. Then she remembered the bleakness of her office after Aaron died. How the company felt like a deflated blimp. How she felt like a deflated blimp as well.
"I'm extra good. My friends are just incredible. It's like a college apartment, but no one's messy or drunk or failing out. We're having one adventure after another. But I'm calling because I have a super idea. I just bought two special garden antiques for the house we're leasing in Tuscany. You just cannot find anything remotely like these things anywhere else."
Molly knew. She has a furniture and bricolage picker in France, and less for more and more seems to be the rule.
they decide that Susan will buy half a container to ship back to Artful Dodge Antiques. Fountains, fan lights, gates, garden furniture, statues, railings, convent sinks, table bases. Endless. They'll see how it goes.
Then you come home, girl. We miss you. Wasn't it terrific when we played house? And we got all those babies sold for top dollar, too.
We did. Now Southern Gardens will be transformed. This will be fun.
Julia pours red wine into her braising pan, and the comforting smell of sizzling onions draws everyone over to see what's cooking.
Time to start celebrating again, Susan tells them, and I have news to share.
She finishes setting places for six, then takes out Prosecco glasses and pours. She guides them out into the cold, shining light on her treasures. They're now guarding our house, and the astrolabe will help in case we lose our bearings in the universe. Just then, Colin and I walk down the hill toward them, swinging our flashlight. Susan beams light on the archaic smile of Mercury and the mathematical markings on the astrolabe's bands. These are for us, but they've sparked an idea that I am now in hot pursuit of. More later. Rowan arrives, and we all move inside around the fire. He has brought over a few of his publications, and he, Camille, and I pore over them before dinner. Rowan has his fame, if not fortune. Rare book librarians buy his books from Berkeley to Oxford, as do collectors of first and rare editions. I'm beguiled by his offer to publish a limited edition of my work. He's tops. I'm thrilled that he follows my latest poems in literary magazines, difficult poems, quick moments from my unconscious. Impossible for the conscious writing mind to truly represent the unconscious. Built-in failure. But I try. He also brought some Sardinian pecorino called Fiore di Monte that Julia raves about and keeps slicing and piling onto a board with slivers of focaccia, olives she baked with hot peppers, and lemon peel. They're in no rush for dinner. Rowan keeps the kitchen fire stoked and the music of Ennio Morricone playing. When the track from The Mission comes on, Julia says, "Oh, please play that at my next wedding, funeral, whatever." At the table, Susan tells them about calling Molly from Venice and their agreement to try their luck as importers. "This business works well for me because I can find stunning garden antiques and ship them home. Molly pays my bank in North Carolina when she sells them, so I am not earning Italian money. I do not want to get mixed up in Italian taxes. I can't ever earn money here, but I can import from here. Totally legal." "You are amazing. Always coming up with the unexpected. Ha! You got us here with two flicks of your computer screen." Susan pours, and Camille's glass catches a tilting convex reflection of a kitchen full of warmth. "Yes, and you're right," Julia says. "Chris has explained that as his consultant, I am paid in the U.S. Chris. Now he's gone. Julia took him to the train for Rome this morning. He's called from his hotel, already missing San Rocco and Julia. Tomorrow he's back in Napa, back to business, to his son home for holidays, and to planning for the next trip. "Not likely to be a problem for me," Camille observes. Julia has made a beet salad with burrata, followed by stracotto, which just seems like good beef stew to Susan. In San Rocco's four antique shops, Susan finds two vintage terracotta sphinxes, a stone trogolo, a trough for animals and charming as a planter, a Liberty Art Nouveau gazebo that unhooks its parts and lies flat,
a wrought iron trellis, small enough to fit in a pot of climbing clematis.
This is too much fun.
Villa Assunta becomes a temporary exhibition garden.